You're listening to a podcast from the University of Manchester.
I'm here today with Angela. Hi, Angela. I thought maybe if you would like to start off by telling us who you are, what your role is, and where you work.
Hi, my name is Angela Minas. I'm a researcher at the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research based here at the University of Manchester. I do social science research on topics around agriculture, energy, climate change in the global south, and that means lower income countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
Fantastic. So it sounds like the work you're doing is going to have real global impact and the stuff you're getting involved in there. And obviously reducing greenhouse gas emissions on a global scale is the biggest sustainability challenge facing the world today. Can you tell us about how your research is specifically contributing to that goal?
So my work is around agricultural waste and how that could be used for energy. And at the moment, the agricultural waste that I'm working on is rice straw, and that's burnt in open field. And agriculture is very interesting because in that case, the burning itself contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. So if we could minimize or stop the burning, ideally, and use the rice straw or the agricultural waste to produce energy, that would be really good in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and also contributing to other sustainability aspects.
Could you explain a little more about the work you do, specifically explaining to the average layperson what participatory methods and social network research is all about?
We know how other scientists do some laboratory works, and they do comprehensive and complex modeling and analysis in their computers. As a social scientist, I work a lot with people, and the goal is to understand things from their perspective. Participatory methods is one of the things that I use, and this means that I not only ask questions but engage in doing activities with the people, in this case farmers in Southeast Asia that I work with for my research. And one of the tools that I use is called visual network mapping. It's a tool in social network research, and social network research is basically studying the actors and their relationships and the meanings behind these relationships. In the visual network mapping method, what I do is, with my participants, we draw a map of their social network, and that means asking them who influences, for example, their decisions in rice farming or how they use their agricultural wastes. And going through the process in a very participatory manner. And in that case, as a researcher, that means I'm collaborating on an approach with them rather than having the power from the researcher side only. Having that conversation and engaging in meaningful discussions with your participants. And so the methods that I use are series of conversations that I hope are meaningful to both me as a researcher and to the participants. I see my role as a social scientist to also be co-learning with the participants.
Can you explain why it is so important to put the farmers at the centre of the research and co-develop the solutions with them? What benefit does it ultimately bring?
So we know a lot of technologies get developed, and that's a good thing. But in many cases, unfortunately, especially if we look at it from the context of lower income countries, the technology is developed without thinking about the users. Actually, it happens even possibly in the UK when there are new renewable energy technologies that are developed. There is not always a consideration for the people who are going to use them or who has to change practices for them. For farmers, this is very important because we know from research, from experience, and from what we know on what has happened in the field, that they are always treated as passive recipients of technology and innovation. It's very important to involve them, especially at the beginning of the technology development itself, because they're ultimately the user and they're also the producer of the bioenergy innovations, especially for the agricultural waste perspective. They are the farmers. They produce the agricultural produce and whatever waste will come out of that, and they would hopefully be benefiting from it. So they are active participants and should be in their own development.
Has their input ever contributed to a shift in what we do? So I guess working with engineers, they might come up with a solution they think appropriate. Has it ever been the case that any feedback from the farmers or the community has caused something to change direction?
Well, that happens. For example, one of the communities that I've been in Vietnam, I know that an agricultural machinery, a combine harvester, for example, has been donated to this community. But the farmers themselves, they appreciate the technology being donated to them by an international organization. But it's also the case of, is this compatible with their rice fields or not? And so we found that it's not really very much useful to them. And so these conversations, just knowing what is the reality on the ground versus what outsiders, including us as researchers, think would be benefiting to them, that or beneficial to them rather, that's the kind of thing that we want to have. Because when we have these conversations, then we could have the opportunity to know what is actually happening on the ground and co-design solutions, or make sure that whatever solutions we offer as part of our research actually have the people on the ground in mind.
Yeah, because there's no point, I guess, coming up with some amazing technology that does super stuff, but then if no one's going to be using that, it's going to be a problem, isn't it?
So yeah, and it's also a shame. You know, we have lots of amazing research and technology being developed, and for that to not be used in the way that we intend it to be, it would be a shame not to. So I think for me, it's always worth to know the perspective of everyone who will be involved, the stakeholders, as we call them.
Absolutely, yeah. And then you mentioned rice straw in Vietnam and other areas. I'm just thinking about what range of agricultural residues can be turned into sustainable energy sources. Can you give us a range of different examples?
A lot, actually. In Tyndall Centre, we do also have researchers looking at coffee stems. That's an agricultural waste as well from coffee production in Colombia, and how that could be used for bioenergy. I know researchers in Manchester doing research on bagasse from sugarcane, and that could be used and transformed into bioenergy as well. And depending on whatever technology or conversion process that is done, it could either be used for heating, for electricity, for fuel. That's for liquid fuel, which is something that most probably are familiar with. But agricultural waste is a key thing.
So one man or one woman's rubbish can become another man or woman's fuel.
Even animal manure could be used. It has been used a lot in many low-income countries to generate bioenergy, biogas in particular. There are Nordic countries that actually import waste, solid waste, and so that they could harness more bioenergy from it. And that, I think, even just having that conversation gives people a sense of optimism of, like, your waste could not just be waste. It could be something useful.
And you've mentioned some of the countries that you do this work in. It'd be interesting to kind of find out about sort of the challenges that you focus on as well, as the kind of countries that you work in. Is there any kind of difference in the challenges for different areas?
In terms of challenges for agricultural waste and how that could be processed for bioenergy, for example, rice straw burning is common across. In the Philippines, it's one of the studies says even up to 95%. In Vietnam, it's something around 80 to 90% of rice straw burning. So the challenges in terms of burning of agricultural residues is pretty much the same. There is a different set of challenges if we think about how we could possibly talk about the solutions, thinking about their government systems. These are different. In the Philippines, which is a republic, it's a democratic government. In Vietnam, follows a socialist type of government. And in Myanmar, which is formerly an authoritarian government and now just transitioning to a more democratic one. So all these things are, I guess if we think about it from a wider challenges perspective and how we want our research to actually have a policy impact, these are the things that I need, and also other researchers need to be thinking about, and how we communicate the research results to whoever are government and policy actors in these countries. But certainly, there are similarities as well. Agriculture is very much important in terms of their economic sector. It provides income and livelihoods to many of the farmers in these countries. And in terms of willingness to learn, even though these are all Southeast Asian countries, they all have their cultural differences. The willingness to learn and the opportunity to improve themselves and their farming methods, to access energy sources from their agricultural waste is something that that's exciting for everyone.
Are there any sort of challenges or differences around the uptake of bioenergy solutions in certain countries? Would you be able to sort of talk about where those differences come into play?
In terms of just renewable energy, bioenergy is not very much a popular renewable energy sources in the Philippines. Traditional biomass is common across Philippines, Myanmar, and Vietnam. And traditional biomass means using fuel wood and just burning them directly for cooking, for heating, etc. But as a main source of renewable energy, that's very much not a priority compared to solar power, for example, or investments in solar power, in wind energy, in hydro, in all these countries. In Vietnam, they do have bioenergy options, but not from agricultural waste, from animal manure. They have in Myanmar, they have a lot of rice husk, another agricultural waste, gasification that is happening, and it's been around. But these all have challenges. So in the Philippines, I mentioned earlier, it's not very much a priority. And this is where we want to lead with the research. Hopefully, the next step is to communicate that there is potential to do this. And this is an option, a good alternative to stop rice or burning. In Vietnam, it's the same. There's an industry, there's already a lot of things happening on biogas from animal manure, for example. But it would be a bonus to do that. So it has different challenges, technology-wise, how to tell them that there is an opportunity, how to tell the governments, rather, or that there is an opportunity to develop something from the agricultural waste and just expanding the bioenergy sector.
And what do you see as the key benefits of bioenergy over solar, over wind? Is it because we're using waste that would otherwise be waste? We're turning waste into a useful resource.
That's one. And also because there's so much agricultural waste. And if we just let them be waste, it's definitely not the best case scenario. Thinking about energy, there is certainly opportunities for it to help livelihoods of farmers in rural communities. The question shouldn't only be around connecting people to the grid, but making sure that that grid connection actually benefits their households, their livelihoods.
The University of Manchester are heavily involved in this area, are doing some fantastic things, but we're obviously partnering up with other organisations to kind of amplify the research and kind of do more. What would you say about combining different academic disciplines and approaches together, and how has it made those research solutions better?
I am very much a fan of interdisciplinary research because the problems of the world are so complex now that you can't just rely on one discipline or one field to have the answers to everything. And I am very lucky to be able to have the opportunity to work across different disciplines and different partners whilst in Tyndall Centre and in the University of Manchester. In my own research, and I work across in the Philippines and Vietnam project, I work with researchers in the School of Social Sciences, even though I'm based in the School of Engineering, which means I also work with engineers. I also work in Myanmar. I work with people in Earth and Environmental Sciences. So even just within the university, and with researchers and engineers and other disciplines outside the university, it's been good because there are, as I've mentioned earlier, the problems are so complex. It needs partnerships and collaborations to find these solutions.
And you talk about these workshops in the different countries and areas, mm-hmm. and the actors that you engage with. Are they usually male?
Oh, yeah. This is one of the things. All throughout my research, I find it quite challenging to be a relatively young social scientist that is working with a lot of engineers, where people in power are usually male. And in the context of Southeast Asia, where there is quite a hierarchical structure in terms of age, it is challenging to be heard, or challenging to be recognized even with the work that you do. I've definitely had experiences where I was told to not ask questions because it might be offensive and all these things, but then, you know, verifying it, like what you do as a researcher, verifying the translations, it wasn't the case. There are very technical scientists that don't trust the social sciences as much. And it definitely happens. And it is a struggle of every social scientist. And it's extra struggle if you're a female, young, dealing with all older engineers, for example, or all these people in power. It's, again, as I've mentioned earlier, there's always power, representation, and politics around all these things. And what I learned is, one, I learned to be more vocal and basically tell them that I am capable of what I'm doing, that what I'm doing is research-based, evidence-based. And because otherwise, I would just be cornered. And that would make everything that I'm doing not relevant where it should be. And if I'm silenced because of my gender, because of my field, it's not really helpful. So for everyone, really, it has knocked off my self-esteem, but I've learned to triumph over it.
And I guess that's why initiatives such as International Women's Day is so important to changing these stereotypes, breaking down the perceptions, bit by bit, step by step, year by year. And I just want to end by saying big congratulations to you on being recently named an N8 New Pioneer.
Thank you.
That's been great news. And what does that mean for you as a young female early career researcher?
Thank you. I'm definitely humbled. And this is probably something that a woman researcher would say. I feel like I don't deserve this, but maybe if a male gets awarded for it, they will be like, yes, I'm proud of it. So allow me to say, I know I'm humbled, but I am proud and happy that I get awarded the N8 New Pioneers thing. And I do take this as an opportunity to actually make my voice, my female energy researchers, not, and like research in the global south, that is, be heard as a social scientist in a wider landscape. Getting recognized is something I'm grateful about, but it's also something that I should treat as a platform to share more of what we are doing and what our ideas are, what innovations we have in this sphere, in this space, that could potentially have actual global benefits.
Sounds very well deserved. We're looking forward to seeing kind of developments in this field, and hopefully these policy conversations are all going to go very well.
I
look forward to seeing what's happening in the future.
To hear more about our research in advanced materials, cancer, energy, global inequalities, and industrial biotechnology, go to manchester.ac.uk